And this is Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. Striking auto workers need and deserve to win big.
What's going on? There's a war zone here today out in the heartland. But the union's here to stay. Those multinational bastards don't use tanks and guns, it's true. But they declared a war on us right now. And by God, it's up to you. Cause there's a war on the workers. There's a war on the workers. There's a war on the workers. And it's time we started calling the shots.
We have a lot of temporary workers inside all the plants, not just here. The temporary workers have no status and be summarily dismissed at any time.
Just want what's fair to us. A few years back, we gave up a lot to keep this house open and all the houses around General Motors. And now that they're making more money than they ever have, we feel like we should get some of that stuff back too. And the company doesn't want to do that. You know, fair day's pace goes with a fair day's work.
We all submitted resolutions back a couple months ago what we wanted to see in this contract, and they're trying to get that for us. I have total confidence in them, and obviously they weren't going anywhere with it, so they figured we had to strike, so I'm 100% in support of that.
And now, striking auto workers need and deserve to win big with J.R. Baker, president of Powertrain Engine UAW Local 774 in Tonawanda, New York, and Mike Elk, senior labor reporter and founder of the Payday Report, and Nelson Lichtenstein, director of the Center for the Study of Work, Labor, and Democracy at the University of California, and welcome you all. We'll begin with our local president, J.R. Baker, from New York State. And I wanted to ask you about some of the issues that are driving this strike, but also, what is your local like? Who are your members, and what are working conditions at your local up in Tonawanda?
First of all, I'd like to say hi to everybody that's listening right now. Of course, the challenges that we face here are across the nation. All the General Motors plants are out. The key five issues that we are having right now is the fair wages, affordable health care, profit sharing, the job security, which I will speak on in a minute, and having a permanent path for employment for our temporary workers, because some of those workers have been temporary for 5-6 years without no vacation and with only 3 unpaid days off a year. The job security is for them closing plants in the United States while they take the business overseas, which is definitely a problem for us. And we have 1,357 members at our location. But you know what? We also have 12 locations that we're picketing, 12 zones that we're picketing, 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. So we have a great membership that's actually doing their jobs, you know, picketing and fighting for what we feel is right.
And who are your members? What do they do? What does the plant do? And what are some of the conditions in the plant?
We're an engine facility, powertrain engine facility. We make engines for 19 vehicles. Also, our plant consists of production workers and skilled trade workers. So we have all the issues on the table, production and skilled trades-wise. So there's a lot of things going on with trades exactly as far as the lack of apprentices, the workforce can half the workforce can retire, just the growth pretty much. So.
And the mood of the picket line, the workers on the picket line, are they excited by this strike in a certain way? I know they don't want to be on strike, but is there a certain enthusiasm for justice?
Yeah, we all believe when we strike, we win. That's one of the chances that we have out there. Everybody's motivated. You know, there are some challenges overall, but you know what? When we come together and when the community actually come together and help us out like they've been. We have a tremendous amount of support from our community. It's bringing food and supplies for the inclement weather, like ponchos and wood for the barrels to burn fire at night to keep, you know, keep everybody warm. I mean, just the donations from all of the organizations around here has been absolutely incredible. But once again, the workers are the ones that picketing, the ones that's making a difference across the nation, the ones that's sacrificing being away from their families, and walking for their families, is why we out here, you know. And if I can like add up a little bit as far as the direction of why we got to this point, back in 07 when, you know, when the company decided to file bankruptcy and ask for the bailout, the government bailout, they also took concessions from the union. UAW gave up things to actually make everything, you know, the company needed help, so we just, you know, we gave up concessions that we thought we would get back once they became profitable. Well, you know, they became profitable and forgot about us. So we drew the line in the sand, basically said enough is enough. We got to take care of American people, our American workers, and, you know, that's where we are right now today. So everybody is full of energy and pumped up because we're actually walking for the things that we actually deserve. And it's a shame that, you know, people out there that know about General Motors, as far as when the strike started, we had health care, and they took it away, but then they gave it back. You know, so it's the game that they're playing. But these are people's lives that's being affected, that live in the United States of America, the land of the free, the land of the brave, the land of opportunity. And we want an opportunity to grow with the company. And we felt like, you know, the last three contracts, we haven't grown with the company. And in fact, they wanted to reduce pay, create a temporary workforce, which is unacceptable. Really is unacceptable.
And this temporary workforce, what is the disparity in pay and benefits between the temporary workers and the regular workers?
Well, the disparity is that, you know, we believe as a union, everybody should get paid to do the same job. You know, so the disparity coming in, they start off for like $15, and I think they can work up to like $18, but they have no, they have minimum benefits. They have no rights to profit sharing, the temporary workers. They have no path to employment of a permanent status. You know, when I got hired in 1998, it was a path where it either was 90 days, you were permanent, or less than 90 days, they let you go, right? But there's no growth. There's no path. These workers, and that's temporary, don't really have something to look forward to. And like I said, who works here in America that don't have a vacation? You can't even take a vacation with your family. And if you do, you got to get approved, and you only have three unapproved days you can take, or three approved days that you can take without pay. That's not right, you know? So I'm telling you the facts of what's going on, right?
You didn't mention the pay.
Yeah, the pay was $15 to $18 an hour.
Versus other workers?
Versus up to $28 an hour, $30 an hour.
And the other issue I think we should discuss are the layoffs of plant closings throughout the country, especially in Lordstown and Detroit. What's happening there?
You know, they threatened to close these plants. They shut them down, shut two of them down, and they took the jobs like the Blazer. They took that overseas to Mexico and the Trailblazer to China, where they could have brought those vehicles here and made them in those plants that they closed. So that's just simple. Build it here in America. We buy American, so that's what they're doing.
Do you see any progress in the talks, the negotiations?
I don't know anything about that. That's being done in Detroit, and our brothers and sisters there that's negotiating. We, you know, they're keeping it quiet, which they should. You know, we shouldn't get those things out because those things are real sensitive, and they need to be in house with the negotiators. And once they do reach a tentative agreement, they'll let us know and let me know and let all the presidents know and chairs that we, you know, we can move forward and proceed to Detroit. And as a council, we'll vote on the tentative agreement to bring back to the members. And then the members will be the ones ratifying the contract.
And let's bring Nelson Lichtenstein into the discussion. Nelson, you're an historian at the University of California. You've written books on the UAW. How did we come to this point? I mean, this could take an hour for you to discuss, obviously, but the short five-minute version.
Yeah.
How do we come to this point from, say, the 1970 strike, the 2007 strike? What's been happening in the industry with the workers, with the company?
Well, I think the companies, General Motors and others as well, they've had a strategy of basically reducing their workforce, outsourcing and offshoring as much work as they possibly can. And they have the union has fought that. They fought that certainly in the 90s, 80s and 90s, and 2007. But the Great Recession put GM into bankruptcy. And whenever these companies, whether it was Chrysler in 1979, 80, or GM later on, they used bankruptcy as a kind of a tool in order to ratchet down wages and also close as many factories as they can. I think that we're at the point right now in our history, and this is the union, but also beyond that, way beyond that, that we need real controls once again on capital mobility. The era of capital can move anywhere and trade can take place, but people can't move. I think that era is coming to an end, and the union itself is raising the stakes and saying this is an issue that you've got to reopen some of these plants, but this has to be done also at the larger sort of policy, political, level, that companies, the capital they have is not simply their own to either, whether it's to use $1 trillion to buy back, shares, which just enriches individual investors, or to, just choose to close down Lordstown. These plants are built with, they have a social character, they're often built with subsidies, and I think we need a policy here that says we're going to reindustrialize the country. And that means keeping these plants open and opening new ones. And there's plenty of things to be built and done in this country. People are still buying automobiles, and General Motors wants to now move to electric and move to a new different generation. Well, this is all being done in part with federal help, federal funds. And I think that it's a social question. It shouldn't be just left for the executives of General Motors to make these decisions. And so the UAW is right about it, but they need reinforcements, and those reinforcements have to come from the political movements that are stirring right now in the land.
And do you think that the political movements are at a point where they will reinforce this? I know there have been any number of Democratic politicians on the picket lines where in the past, like in the last election, in the last primaries, Senator Clinton sort of stayed out of the process, let the process work out. Bernie was the only one who really came into it seems there's a different dynamic involved.
Right, there is. The classic rhetoric of liberals used to be, we want a level playing field and then let the union and management fight it out. Level playing field, that was the phrase. Well, it isn't a level playing field. The playing field is tilted. And not just because Trump's in the presidency, it's tilted just systemically because of the nature of the capacity of capital to move anywhere at once. And we have to, I'm not for having a level playing field, I'm for having a playing field which is an advantageous to the working class and to the vast majority of Americans. And I think it's time for, that this enormous, it's not just a question of being rich and having money, it's not just a question of billionaires, it's a question of fundamentally, who controls these vast collections of capital, whether it's liquid or whether it's in the plants and the facilities of General Motors? These are not simply private entities; they have a social character. Walter Reuther said that 70 years ago, and I think that that message should resonate today as well.
For those people in the audience who might not know who Walter Reuther is,
he was one of the founders of the UAW and formerly a socialist in the 1930s and then sort of a social democrat in the 40s and 50s. And he always said that, the union is fighting not just for itself, but for the entire American working class. And now I think the American working class has to fight for the union. The union's in a weakened state, but I think that it requires reinforcements from the American populace, which is moving to the left in general.
What sort of reinforcements? I mean, we talked before about the New York strike of people bringing food and clothing and turning up on the picket line. Do you think we need more of that?
Oh yeah, I mean, I've said this. I haven't seen as much as it should be. I'm not just for having one politician or show up and then give a speech and then leave. The supporters of the politicians should call upon their supporters, people who are that they have on their email list and everything, to go down to the picket lines and not
Bernie
just have
does
picket
that.
Lines. Yeah, well, and you know, have ticket signs of 1,000 and 2,000 the way it used to be, and three, you know, and make these mass picket, make this strike a social movement in a big way. I think GM, by the way, did cave on those. On health insurance,
yeah.
they caved on that because it was both embarrassing and there was an outcry about it.
So just in terms of further the temper of the times, I mean, both Bernie and Elizabeth Warren are talking about this wealth tax and really bring up the social inequality of work,
mm-hmm.
of wealth, wherever they
mm-hmm.
can. Do you think that feeds into this whole thing in terms of the UAW strike?
Well, it does. That's important. But Warren happened to have a proposal, which I don't want to be forgot, which I think that the board of directors of all these major corporations that have should have 40% workers on them, and I think as they do in some places in Europe, and I think that should be taken seriously. That, you know, that's, we're talking about power there and control. Or at least having a veto anyway. And there was a period back in the 80s when Douglas Fraser and other UAW leaders were on the executive board of directors of Chrysler for a moment there. And I think that would be I hope that becomes a major theme in the campaigns as they proceed. This is not just a question of money. Money's important, but it's a question of power. And I want the unions and the working class in general to have more of it.
And Mike Elk, let's bring you into this conversation. You've been traveling around in your car, I assume, to different picket sites around the country, and in the South also. What have you found in terms of the mood of the workers?
Well, I think the mood is upbeat, but obviously it's entering the third week. People are tired. Paychecks aren't coming through anymore. You know, people are starting to realize the hit it took on their finances. But at the same time, it should be noted that a lot of GM workers worked overtime, saved up, and prepared for this year in advance. So, you know, how it's being felt is uneven across the board. The feeling I got in the South was the most extraordinary. You know, I lived in Chattanooga, Tennessee for some time and covered, you know, all three of the different union elections they've had there in Chattanooga at the Volkswagen plant. You know, UAW just lost a recent union election there by 29 votes in June. And what I found most interesting is the effect that the GM strike is having on building support in those shops that the UAW hasn't been able to organize in the South. You know, I talked with workers at Volkswagen in Chattanooga, and this really helped them make the case because, you know, the UAW has been, you know, really hurt with a corruption scandal, which has seen five top UAW officials convicted of taking bribes. And what this strike has really done is help the UAW rebrand itself and show itself as a fighting union in those places. And I talked with workers at Volkswagen and Chattanooga who felt this really has given them a boost as they keep fighting the company. You know, I talked with workers at Nissan in Canton, Mississippi, where the UAW lost nearly 2-1 in the summer of 2017. And, you know, Nissan was trying to use the strike against the UAW, putting up electronic billboards around the plant, telling people, you know, look at what the UAW is doing. But it's backfired. So you know, what I found when I was in Spring Hill, Tennessee, and elsewhere, is that support, even in the South, which is the fastest growing part of the country for unionization, is very strong, and that the GM strike is having a big effect in terms of the ability of the UAW to go and organize in the South in the future.
And Mike, in terms of the strike overall, in terms of public support, what have you found? Have people been honking their horns in the picket lines? Have drivers, have people been bringing things to the picket lines, joining the picket lines? What have you found in general as you travel to the country?
I mean, the only thing I can ever compare to what I've covered in my career was the first day of the West Virginia teacher strike, the kind of electric energy and the mass outpouring and people pulling over their cars on picket lines to give people goodwill wishes, community groups donating, restaurants donating. We were even just in Cleveland, Ohio, where a number of local GM dealers donated cars to ferry people back and forth from the union hall to the picket line. So, you know, this is really garnered mass public support. And as you can tell, Donald Trump has remained totally silent on this, in part because he's concerned that if he comes out against the UAW in places like Michigan, that it will really hurt him win a state like that again. So, you know, there's big public support behind it. The big problem I'm seeing is that, you know, in most mainstream newsrooms, this isn't getting much coverage outside of the financial press and a handful of local papers. This hasn't been elevated by the national media to the level of attention that a strike of this level should garner. And that's sad, and that's depressing. And, you know, the only reason I was able to cover it is, you know, when I was fired during the union drive at Politico in 2015, I won a $70,000 settlement, and I used that money to start a small publication called Payday Report, cover labor news and news deserts. And we were able to raise $5,000 off our readers to drive around and travel and do this. And so it's clear that union members are willing to pay and donate good money to support labor reporting. But, you know, the national media is just, you know, it's run by a bunch of rich white kids. And they have a worldview that's very set of the kind of worldview that rich white kids have. And I, you know, I say this as somebody who grew up in a union household in Pittsburgh in a pretty mixed income working class setting. And, you know, it's troubling to see this get really ignored by most of them.
You mentioned before the teacher strikes last year, and you talked about there have been actually a mini wave of strikes leading up to the UAW strike, including Marriott, including Stop and Shop. What do you see the effect of this strike, as hopefully it'll win, on unionization throughout the country?
Well, I think it's going to definitely give a boost to unionization. Right now, unions have an all-time high approval rating of 64%, according to Gallup. That's the highest rate since 1947. So, you know, having a big win like this, showing that you can win against a major corporation, will spawn more strikes at other places, places that we won't hear of, places that are small shops, maybe only a couple hundred people. But this is really inspiring people in the same way that I think the teacher strikes inspired people, and you're going to see more and more action being taken.
I thought what Mike said was really interesting about the strike boosting support for the UAW in Chattanooga and other places in the South where these transplants are have been set up. And I think what he's point is here that the union had made the argument earlier, certainly in Chattanooga and other places, that, you know, we're gonna if the union wins, it's just simply you know, lay the basis for more, you know, union management cooperation. You know, we aren't you know, it's not a us versus them. That had been the, to some extent, the UAW line. But I think the mood in the country today is, yes, there is a us versus them, and, you know, we need to fight and mobilize. And I think that what Mike says there is really important, and I think it shows that, you know, if you want to organize the South, which is so important in terms of the UAW, because these transplants now have almost half the entire auto production in the country, and they're non-union, you know, you need to show that you can fight, and I think that's what people want to hear, want to do.
And J.R. Baker, we're going to give you the last words to tie it all up and to talk about where the union is going and the impact on the larger society.
Well, right now, you know, the strike is costing corporations, General Motors, you know, a lot of money. I mean, it's right now, it adds up to nearly $1 billion. And really, technically, since the government bailed out General Motors, I think they kind of forgot, you know, that it was the taxpayers that helped out, but they actually are the ones that's being punished by this as well. I mean, when someone gives you something to help, you don't turn your back on them. And a lot of people are being affected by the strike other than the auto workers. I mean, other businesses nearby. I mean, the people that rely on, you know, we're the middle class, you know, and the middle class is being forgotten about, you know, and we actually, and that's why the community is coming out, because we all support each other. You know, we're in survival mode. You know, we're trying to, we're not asking for nothing but just to grow with our company. As you know, there's different challenges with pay and benefits. There's different challenges with keeping a company from not taking jobs overseas and forgetting about us. And they want to bring the cars back here and sell them to us. And, they, you know, they make them for pennies overseas. It's unfortunate how a company can forget what we are here as American people. Like, you know, you had a dream. Once upon a time, you had this vision that, you know, you get a job, you grow with the company, and you can take care of your family, right? But now it's like they want to cut the job, the pay in half, but have you work all these hours, but then only to say that, you know what, we don't want you to get hired permanent. We don't want you to have a pension. We don't want you to even have cost of living. Everything goes up. The prices of everything skyrockets over the, you know, when they come out with this electrification, which they haven't,
And it's a proven fact that only 1% or 2% of customers want the electrification vehicles because, guess what? There's no infrastructure for these vehicles, so there really is no need for it as we speak. So it's just like, listen, let's sit down in good faith. General Motors need to understand that what we're asking for, we once had it before they went bankrupt. That was just a tool. You know, that was just a strategy to get stuff from the union. I mean, make no mistake about it. We're fighting every day for the things that we're entitled to. And I think everybody in America can agree that would they work a job where you don't have a vacation, would they work a job where you got to deal with your wages getting cut in half or your pension getting sliced after, you know, the company's been profitable. I mean, I'm talking about billions and billions of dollars over the last three contracts. And you know what? We've been going down every contract. We've been giving up. They cut the pensions for the new workers coming in progression, the different pay scales. It's just unfair how you know. And people don't know. America doesn't know. So that's why this strike is real powerful, because it's letting everyone know that it's not us, the UAW workers. It's the company, the corporate greed, the not willing to like, just take care of us and just forget the people that bailed them out.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there, and we definitely agree with you, and I know that everybody that's listening to the shows agrees with you, and that'll be multiplied a million times through. So good luck on the strike. Good luck not only for you, but for all of us. And we'll be speaking to J.R. Baker, president of Powertrain Engine Local, UAW 774 in Tonawanda, New York. Mike Elk, senior labor reporter and founder of Payday Report. And Nelson Lichtenstein, director of the Center for Study of Work, Labor, and Democracy at the University of California. Thanks for listening.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.